Welcome to the panel. I expect everyone knows everyone, but I'm going to very briefly introduce the panel from left to right. Frederica Durema, Director of Mathematics, Information, and Life Sciences at the Air Force Office of Scientific Research. Next to her is Robert Conrick, Vice President of Apple's Media Apps and Content. Craig Himmelmann, CTO of Sidewalk Labs. And finally, Jim Gross, Assistant Director of the Director for Computer and Information Science and Engineering at the National Science Foundation. So today's panel is convened on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the department. So we're celebrating past achievements, of course. But our goal today is not to look back on the past, but rather to peer into the future. So I'd like to marshal the panel members' powers of prophetic foresight and direct it in the form of several leading questions. So our hope is to glean a few ideas from the panel members' responses and from the Q&A that follows that will help us shape the department's ongoing pursuit of excellence, opportunity, and leadership in computer science. So here then are the questions. What are the research frontiers in computer science that lie just beyond the horizon? What are the underexploited opportunities for collaboration, not only with the usual suspects, like medicine and engineering, but the unusual suspects, like arts and humanities? What are the emerging workforce needs of the nation in the short, middle, and long term? And how should the academic computer science community respond? So I'd like each panelist to pick up one or more of these questions and provide a 5-minute response, after which we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. I could flip a coin, or perhaps we could just start with Barbara and move down the line. Frederica. So why don't we begin with you?
Transferring methods from one field to another. I believe science, in a sense of technology, advances synergistically and in a related way. Sometimes ideas that are very good, methodologies that are very good, cannot be implemented because of other factors, technological barriers. As some aspects of the technology advance, then some of these ideas become mature. So this kind of interplay, it's always very important. And certainly, I always think that the academic community has tremendous resourcefulness and imagination to bring together many areas that we in the agencies have not even thought put together. I mean, certainly the opportunities for the, in a sense, for example, human performance, even dancing, that you know, methods in a sense of tracking the dancers and improving the performance of dancers certainly can have impact, improving the performance of a soldier or an athlete, or even a human being that maybe is recovering from an operation and so on. So these are some possibilities. Interactions across the fields of medicine, biology, psychology are being explored and certainly will be explored more. So in terms of emerging workforces, Jim Gross provided very nice statistics in terms of the computer science needs. But I believe overall there is need for all STEM fields. I am a kind of a geek and a technology believer, and I think the wealth of the nation, the well-being of the nation, will be accomplished by having a workforce that is educated in STEM fields. Technology has been an enabler and competitor for our own lives, and also an important enabler of economic prosperity. And so, certainly, this is in the United States for a number of years, the kind of US point of view, as I say, was not attracted to STEM fields. There were other fields that a lot of the smart young people that had, in a sense, aptitude in math, science, engineering, were attracted to, like medical fields, law, business schools. And I think right now we have a reverse that STEM education is increasing. I think programs that mature the high school students, middle school students, always I felt that a lot of the kids in elementary school, they are interested in sciences. They are there are museums, the aquariums, the National History Museums, and so on. There's interest. That interest wanes in the middle school and certainly in the high school. And I believe, in a sense, attracting these students at this at the cusp of the middle school and the high school are very important. The computer sciences provides a lot of nice opportunities for the young people to be involved in these fields and become interested in science. And there are many robotics competitions, science fairs. Increase those, I think, increase also the interest. So certainly, both in the short and the long run, I think the nation will need to nurture many more students to go into scientific fields. And also, the other thing is teachers, because I think it makes a difference to the students when they have a teacher teaching them physics or math. And they do not have a degree in that field, which is happening for the education, especially in the middle school. I believe that is a problem. And I think President Obama actually put the finger in the right spot when he said we need to have 100,000 kind of teachers being produced every year for the next years to, in a sense, bridge this gap. So with that, I'm very hopeful.
probably are using right now and are going to use next year and the year after. So my answer is going to be a little different, and I'm actually, the bulk of what I'm going to talk about later today is actually wrapped around these questions, so I'll keep it brief. But in terms of near-term opportunities and development, I think augmented reality is very important. Machine learning as opposed to AI is very important in the short term. And when people call cybersecurity, but it's getting to the point where privacy and security on the internet is almost an oxymoron, and this cannot stand, and it won't. That's near and dear, to my heart and to Apple's heart too, in protecting of people's information. The question of computer science and the arts is interesting because I live this every day. And I think the top line thing I would say is that most of the arts, not all, but most of the arts have not adapted at all to the world of computers. And I'm going to give you a very simple example. You've watched TV for the same way for 50 years. It's linear. It's starting to be on-demand viewing, but the opportunity to disrupt the TV ecosystem is just amazing in terms of what can be done and is not being done today. In fact, I'm here today, and for the first time in a long time, a product that my design team designed was launched this morning in Cupertino, and I wasn't there. It's very weird watching it on the net. There's just example after example of this, and I'll go through it a little bit more in a bit. I think the question of workforce is interesting, and there's two components of this. The first is, of course, getting people involved in what was referred to as STEM, and that's a part of it, but one of the hardest things that my organization does is get someone like some of the students in the room here to be able to work and interact and form a cohesive team with someone that spent their whole college existence in a pub up the street listening to local bands. Try to get people like that to talk to each other and understand each other and present a entertainment product on the other end that people consume and love is exceedingly difficult. And I'll talk about that a little bit more too.
So one of the things I noticed at Google, and even more so at Sidewalk Labs, is how much, I trained as a computer scientist and thought almost exclusively about software, but how much hardware is becoming a bigger and bigger and more important part of the things we think about in computer science. So for example, right now I'm trying to hire a great hardware engineer who has an electrical engineering background. I feel like this part of the story from a Google point of view would show for the self-driving car, which is using some pretty amazing AI, some pretty amazing database and systems engineering, some pretty amazing telecommunications engineering. But the fundamental thing is that all of this is embedded in a real thing that actually moves around the world. And I'm not telling you anything by saying that many of these devices now float around the world. Kaz mentioned the machine room, but that's where all the computing used to be, right? And now, I don't know about most of the computing, but it's possible that most of the computing is sort of floating around in people's hands, if you talk about your total computing capabilities. And that's really interesting, because it takes computer science out of this a little bit disembodied sense into something that's really embodied in the world, it's bumping into things, sometimes literally. And that's really interesting for a number of areas. For a number of reasons. First, that we're physical beings, and physical stuff matters, right? So you care if stuff comes into you or doesn't come into you. So there's kind of a raising of the stakes. We're not just talking about software, but the software is going to govern what happens in hardware, and the hardware actually matters to us as embodied beings. But it also is interesting, and I feel like I'm an apologist for Dimitri on the computer vision front, but sensors are becoming so much cheaper that there's so much information flowing in from the outside world, and that's going to continue to increase at an incredible pace, to the point where I suspect at some point, not too many years from now, every part of the public sphere is going to have a pixel focused on it. That's going to challenge us from a privacy point of view. That's become, going to become much more critically important. It's already a big issue, but it's not going to get any easier. But also, really, it's a huge opportunity, right, to have real-time knowledge, potentially, about every bit of the physical space, and in many cases, private spaces as well. That's a huge challenge in terms of the blocking and tackling, you know, networks. How do we make sure the next networks can handle this, the infrastructure storage and backends. But then also artificial intelligence, machine learning, which is already excels at ingesting enormous amounts of data and making sense of it, but the challenge is going to get much, much harder. And correspondingly, I think the opportunities become much, much more interesting. Once we understand what's going on in the world at a detailed level, moment to moment, and at every possible location, what do we then understand better about the world? And then based on that understanding, how do we actually improve the way the world works, on a day-to-day basis for people in the real world? I think that's incredibly exciting. I think it's gonna engage all of the things we're currently working on and really challenge us. So I think from a computer science research point of view, starting to figure out ways of getting in the middle of those streams of data, understanding what they're useful for, what they're not useful for, and some of the techniques that are going to have to be developed to actually make sense of those in the future.
I have a friend who once, when she was on panels or discussing things, she would always say she would do it different from what she talked about before. And once I saw her sit there and not say anything, which was a statement, I guess. But I mean, during my talk, I did talk about this 15-year looking forward vision, and sort of one slide I would sort of commend to give by my director. I think maybe the thing I'd focus on here is, again, just to put an exclamation point about the role of humans in computing and human-centered computing again, because I do agree that I think autonomy will be very important, but I think the real challenges over a 10 or a 20-year time frame are really going to be how we as humans use technology. So I'm pretty confident that we can build wonderful things, and I don't at all sort of downplay the technical challenges of the networking databases and all the various technologies that Clay was just talking about growing in the I believe we can. I believe we can do that. I think the much harder things is how humans work together, how we craft those systems so that we work together in the best way possible. I think that's going to involve really reaching out to other disciplines, social sciences, to really study how we're best going to be able to do that. The one last point I make has to do again with workforce and education, because I think it's the responsibility of everybody to sort of keep addressing that. We talked about computer science for all, what's happening at the high school level. I think a challenge that's going to directly, that we face today already, we're doing a great job with our deeply technical computer science majors that teach here at Rutgers and at other universities. I think reaching out to the other students across campus, the X+CS, computational thinking, and hoping those students find they'll need that for meaningful work, and they'll need that generally.
Good. Thank you all for those very stimulating comments. I think the idea is we're going to have some microphones circulate in the audience, and we'd like to hear your questions and get the reactions of the panel. While that's setting up, I'll start off with one question, and you can volunteer as you'd like to answer. And it's around the area of privacy. So I want to ask the question by telling this story. We are starting a undergraduate certificate program here at the School of Arts and Sciences on intelligence studies. And the instructor's reaction to the first version of the intro course was the realization, which he described as stunning, that the 18 and 20-year-old students in his class had no expectation of privacy. These are kids who have grown up with social media, and for them it's a virtue to put themselves out there. And so I think we all sort of understand that about the younger generation. But the instructor is a very distinguished lawyer, and he said he was so struck by this lack of expectation of privacy that he considered it as undermining the foundations of the Fourth Amendment. Right? If you have no expectation of privacy, why would you expect to have a protection from unreasonable search and seizure by the federal government? So this is an ill-formed question, but how are we going to begin to address the what amounts to a social effect from the use of technology and in the privacy sphere?
One aspect of this is that people are more willing, I think, to participate in applications and systems that require some private information from them if they understand that there's some value that they receive from that. So I'm not sure that privacy completely exists in a vacuum, but if people understand that there's a transaction going on and they're willing to sacrifice some privacy, for example, in the Facebook case, making their profile public in order to communicate with friends and colleagues. I think people are becoming increasingly good at making those kinds of trade-offs and understand sometimes that in order to get routed to a particular location on Google Maps, they need to say where they are right now and where they're going, and they understand that travels through somebody's network. So I think it's possible, it certainly seems true that people are less concerned about privacy, but it's also true that people are becoming more sophisticated about understanding what those trade-offs are and what the benefits are to participating in networks that require them to give up some information.
And I agree with that. I think on the privacy side, like in many things in life, it's a pendulum, right? And the internet came along and these 20-year-olds are like, oh, everything's out there. But I think as time goes on, it'll swing back somewhat in the middle. Things won't be as private as they were, but people are going to want some level of control over what they share and not share, and not have their stuff hacked every day. It's amazing to me that the majority of people don't even understand what can happen to them and how. If you ask somebody, how does a thief break into their house, they have a visual, right? The guy in a mask, something's banging on the door, or breaking it open. They don't even understand. And this will evolve over time, but social systems and people's behaviors don't keep up with the technology, and I think that's the situation we're in right now.
Jim, did you have a comment?
I agree with that comment that our social systems aren't keeping up with the technology. Craig, you made an earlier comment about that people are becoming more sophisticated in their understanding of privacy, and I guess maybe a follow-up question to that is, do you think that when people are participating in applications that they actually have an understanding of what privacy goes along with that?
I agree that they don't necessarily have it, that there's probably a deeper understanding that they need, but I think a lot of younger people have grown up in an environment where they're participating in these apps, and so I think they have a deeper understanding than maybe even an older generation does. But I don't question the idea that people probably need a deeper understanding. There are some unforeseen implications that they haven't really deeply understood.
Totally agree. And when this 20-year-old is 35 or 40 years old, and has money in the bank and a 3-year-old kid, and they don't want the kid being exposed, I that's the pendulum part, I think.
I agree, and that's what I was going to say, that maybe the young people, they're not, in a sense, inhibited for disclosing what they have for lunch or dinner, but it's the bank. Or as Robert said, children or other aspects. I believe there are still challenges in terms of, certainly there are pros and cons, as you said, and you need to weigh them, but I think there are still challenges in terms of security and how we enable security for their privacy. That there are opportunities for computer science to address.
So maybe I could just ask another question, because it's always easier to ask questions than answer questions. But this has to do with, I mean, we're here in a computer science happen, it seems that maybe they're more about organizational use of security or non-use of security as opposed to, you know, a deep technical flaw. Certainly there are technical flaws. I'm wondering just about, especially from our colleagues from industry, if you have a good feel about sort of that balance between where the work is really needed. Is it really on the technology, or is it more on the use of the technology, or understanding it, a more sophisticated understanding?
The new computer science. Look, there were cell phones before, right? Nobody could use them. And then takes an apple to understand what the user wants. Same thing with privacy, anything that an engineer builds. Okay, you build it because you think it like an engineer, you don't think like the user. So the same thing like security. You can pull as many theorems as you want, and all the systems are being hacked. So it doesn't work. Traditional theory-based approach doesn't work. And again, the best theory. Now there's machine learning. Again, machine learning has limitations. Only when we understand how people use things, which expose themselves to vulnerability, that's when it's going to happen. That's why programs for X so important.
So I'll take a shot at this. You were asking whether it's the systems or the people, and I think in some ways it's both. But I'll give you a concrete example. Two-factor authentication, right? Two-factor authentication is available on Apple's products on iCloud, for example, hopefully from your bank and your brokerage. How many of you use it? Right? That's good, but even...
That's only 20%.
But even in this room, and you know what can happen to you. You know why people don't use it? It's a pain. It is pain. And I have two-factor on my accounts, because sometimes people are interested in what's in them. Right? But it's a pain to use. My wife doesn't like using it, I make her use it. And in there is part of the idea. It's the two-factor does a lot to keep people from hacking into your accounts. It's not perfect, but it does an awful lot. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult, and it's difficult to navigate and use all the time. And we need something that's as secure as that, that's basically a push of a button for a person. Like on a car, you know, and cars, late model cars, a lot harder to just hot wire them and steal them. You gotta put them on flatbeds and take them away. Why? Because when you push the button on the key, you're turning off the computer, there's an encryption, there's a code, there's a back and forth. All these things, it just happens for the end user, they don't think about it. And we need to get to that point.
So questions from the audience, please. Just raise your hand, we'll bring a microphone to you.
So anytime there is a tectonic shift in technology, a lot of the workforce is displaced, right? Like for example, earlier, what was happening was there used to be factories, we would train people and like, they would get jobs. And you see a similar thing with computer science. Like we see like, a lot of demand for computer programmers or computer technologists. We train them and they get into the workforce. There will be another shift, like for example, some of the examples that Craig was providing. So there will be shifts, so we need to train them for the future generations, right? Like not just like for, we cannot be reactive. So what are the things that we need to keep in mind when we are developing the next generation workforce?
Well, learning to learn is obviously a big skill that universities teach. And I remember, so the undergraduate class that I taught at Rutgers when I was there was 314, which was the programming languages, which is kind of a blast because you know, you'd bring in these students who had learned Java and then maybe learned another language, and then like every like few weeks you were like, okay, so here's Scheme, okay, so here's Prolog, and you watch their sort of minds explode. And I think by the second time I taught Prolog, I'm like, oh, I get this finally. But there was a sense to which, you know, as part of your degree, it's not that we're teaching you to program, it's that you're teaching programming this language, we're teaching you to learn how to learn languages. And so when I'm hiring people at Google and outside Work Labs, it's the people who, it turns out that, for example, it's hard to find people with a deep knowledge of technology who also have a deep background in urbanism, basically. Sort of obvious to say in retrospect, but I was trying to find those people. So what you need to find is people who are great in one area, say deep computer science or software engineers, that are passionate about cities, in my example, and you bring them on and you teach them, and other people who join and say, yes, I want to learn about this new thing. And I think that's a pretty big responsibility for universities to help people into that mindset.
To your question, we look to Chris Herrick, who's responsible for these programs, and our team's working on a starting program in urban informatics. So smart, so big cities, so from the Boston School of Planning and SAS. So that's also the point.
So, Dimitri, I think that was an assertion, not a question.
No, it was.
I would want to gap that exists in the definition of disciplines. Computers and computer science start with the building of large computers or computers for scientific applications. It's only later than what is now computer science came about. And so initially the two were going together. For example, we had numerical analysis, of which I'm a good example, in a department of computer science. But as time has gone on, the two have been completely separated. And I would argue that, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's large, of the young kids that say, gee, that are interested in the scientific application of computers, like the aerospace program, all the scientific application of computers that they see and a very nice program that say, gee, I want to do that. And they go in a science computer department, like this one, which is completely different. They're totally away from the scientific applications. And so there's a gap there, which I've been very much aware of, and it's a question that should be addressed. I think that a few years ago, St. Princeton had started a program, not a department, a program in computation and applied mathematics that were just doing that. But we have nothing like here.
I'd be happy to make a few comments on that. I think you're spot on about the, there isn't sort of a well-accepted model for how the computational aspects of science and engineering, or more broadly, computational science fits into an academic structure. So I think it was Bill Tang at Princeton who started that program, but there's Georgia Tech, UIUC, University of Texas. There are a few schools that actually have programs in computational science, but generally, my observation is it tends to find computational science according to where the research interests of the faculty happen to be. So it might be courses taught in physics or chemistry or geosciences. And there hasn't been that gelling of what the model's going to be for how to do computational science in academia. With the rise of data science, it's been interesting to think about where data science, how far it's come in a relatively short period of time, and how you start to see some ideas gelling up well at the intersection of statistics and domain sciences and computer science and institutes forming. That hasn't happened as much in computational science over a couple of decades as quickly as it's happened in data science. I'm not quite sure why, but just an observation.
Okay, questions, please.
The gentleman from Apple said that you were convinced that the current security and privacy issues were unacceptable and would not stand. The unacceptable, I understand. The will not stand, I'm curious. It sounds like you have a kind of hope that I find it a little hard to recognize in the current situation. Could you give us some sense of why you think it won't stand?
Because I think it's unsustainable. And I think there's going to be an event. I don't know what it's going to be. That's going to be the tipping point. And people are going to say enough. This is a panel we'll talk about projections, and prognostications. It's something will happen somewhere that will tip it to the point where people wake up to the level of exposure that they've
got. But suppose the entire population rises up and says, enough, we won't use your junk until you solve the security problem. What are you going to do about it?
What am I going to do about it, or are we going to do about it?
Well, we obviously.
There are people that are on the fringe that already got off the grid, right, and don't use the internet.
Well, I won't use the Internet of Things until the problem is solved.
Well, there you go. You're an example of someone who said enough.
But what are you going to do about it? I mean, in the end, I'd like to be able to do it.
Speaking for Apple for a second, privacy is one of the pillars that we base our company on, and we take a lot of grief, including fighting with the federal government over it, as you're probably aware. And so speaking for the organization that I'm with, I do think we're trying to do something about it. It's not an easy problem.
So one of my favorite aphorisms of Nietzsche is, all civilizations are built on blood, meaning a crisis of some kind. Some blood has to be spilled before things fundamentally change. And I think, Robert, that is what you're indicating. Yeah. We have time for one more question. Stupid right here.
Hi, so I'm an undergraduate here, and it's been really amazing to just look back at where we've been in the past and where we're going in the future. I'm just wondering, as someone who's interested and is really amazed about all this, how can I jump in? It's a bit daunting, especially when I'm considering what I'm being taught today. Do you guys have any advice on an undergrad or just people who are interested in hopping in, and how can I contribute to this type of growth in the future?
What are you interested in?
I mean, at this point, I'm just the field of computer science in general. Like, I came in as someone who liked programming, but just at this very event, I'm discovering so many different ways that computer science is impacting the world, and I'm just wondering how I could kind of dive in.
So to answer that question, and maybe simultaneously the question that you didn't ask, you know, you know, which is like, how would I get a job at Google or Apple or Facebook or, you know, or DTI, or, you know, which is, I think it's pretty exciting that with open source, you know, the number of open source projects and the number of pieces of hardware that are kind of advanced in terms of hobbyists, you know, Raspberry Pi and Arduino and all the things, various things you can plug in and order from SparkFun and Adafruit and so on, the potential for you to just go out on your own and build something. Make a device, you know, make it do something really interesting, contribute to an existing open source project. There's just huge potential there. And the reason I bring up the other question that you didn't ask, which is that when we look at resumes at Google and Sidewalk Web, we look at people who've done exactly that, who didn't just do their coursework, but also took the opportunity to get involved in things and projects that were impacting the real world in terms of software that people are using, or building things and telling people about them. I think there's an immense opportunity to get involved in those kinds of things.
I should use your imagination, which you seem to have quite a bit of, and keep your enthusiasm, and you'll find opportunity. There are plenty. When you see all the apps that have been created, and in the Washington Post, I read, and they have a second page now on new apps. Every time I read them, I'm amazed how people thought of that. And they're contributing and making people's lives better.
So I would encourage you, as I encourage a lot of undergraduates who are at a brick and mortar university, to take advantage of the people around you. And you'll find like-minded groups of students who are interested in what you're interested in. You've got other undergraduates, you've got professors around. You should really take full advantage of all of the people around you.
All right. Well, thanks very much to the panelists and to the audience, and let's give them a round.